Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, there's an organization in Columbus that provides help for loved ones of those who die by suicide. We'll learn more about Lost Community Services. Also, the Contemporary Theater of Ohio was formerly known as CATCO. With their name change come more theatrical offerings. We'll hear about what they have planned for their new season, as well as what's on stage right now. And there's a new professional sports team in the capital city. I'll talk to a player from the Columbus Fury women's volleyball team. And Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, joined today by Angela Damon. She's the Executive Director of Lost Community Services in Columbus. We're going to learn what that organization does and about a special event that they have coming up to raise some much-needed funds to support their mission. Hi, Angela. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Kate. I really appreciate the opportunity to share about this.
To start, tell us what Lost does.
Absolutely. Loss is a local outreach to suicide survivors. So losing someone to suicide can be a particularly life-upending and traumatic form of loss. And so we come alongside the survivors, the family members, the friends who are left behind to offer them support on this grief journey. We do this through a variety of programs where we do some scene response in those initial moments, but we also have support groups. We have virtual gatherings. We have events and education and some prevention services as well.
It seems like in recent years, especially, we have had a lot more robust conversation in our society about mental health, about issues like suicide. And I can only imagine that for your purposes, that can be helpful. At least we're more comfortable talking about these things. But what exactly was it that got Lost started?
I'm so grateful that things are starting to change. There's so much stigma around it. And so it's easier to talk about it, but definitely better than it has been. Lost was started 10 years ago by a mother who lost her son, Dre, to suicide. And at the time, she realized that there really wasn't anything there for her, that there wasn't anything for survivors. And a woman, kind of an acquaintance in her church, actually showed up at her home a few days later with, you know, a casserole and just to offer condolences. And our founder, Denise Meinigram, was so impacted by that. This other woman had also lost a son to suicide. And so to see someone who had gone through the same thing and was functional, right? Like, had driven herself across town, had made a casserole. Denise couldn't imagine ever doing those things in her life again. But seeing this woman who was, that gave her a lot of hope. And so that really planted those seeds of survivors supporting one another and being that installation of hope that it's difficult, it's painful, but that you will get through this, you will survive it as well.
You hear that so often repeated in different traumatic circumstances when you can see someone who's gone through it, when you have that sense of representation of, okay, there's another side of this. It is so very helpful to people going through that very profound kind of grief that so many of us can't even understand.
Absolutely. I acknowledge counseling can be really important and valuable for people. But that peer support, that representation, like you mentioned, offers something that doesn't. And so counseling is great, but I think there's a place for peer support as well that isn't substituted by anything else.
Lost Community Services provides that support for people who are coping with the shock, grief, and very complex emotions that often accompany the loss of a loved one to suicide. And they've been doing this for 10 years. We're talking with Angela Damon, the Executive Director of Lost Community Services. Coming up here in just a couple of weeks, they have a pretty popular event that has come back just for this year, the Loss Bowl for Loss and Win event. Angela, tell us a little bit more about this upcoming event.
Yeah, this historically had been our annual fundraiser. And this year, just kind of between events, we decided to bring it back just for 1 year because it's so much fun. A lot of what we do is heavy, is somber. It's focused on honoring loved ones who have gone before. And this is a time just to bring the full family and come out and bowl for a couple hours. It's going to be at Sequoia Bowl in Columbus, and we fill up the whole bowling alley, or try to at least. And it's fun. It's raising money for this cause that impacts many people on a personal level, but just has that more approachable and fun aspect to it.
It's happening on Saturday, May 4th, starting at noon, as Angela mentioned, at Sequoia Bowl on Sandalwood Boulevard in Columbus. The website for Lost Community Services has more information. That's losscs.org. And while you're there, you can learn about the many more events that the organization puts on throughout the year. Angela, I understand there are some remembrance events that Loss does to honor the memories of those that are lost to suicide, correct?
Absolutely. Our next one coming up is the Survivor Day Butterfly Release, and that is at the end of July, July 27th. And it's a morning where survivors gather together. We usually do a poem or a reading of the names, and then people are invited to release their butterfly on their own. They can do it with the group, they can go off on their own. And it's located at a beautiful space, an outdoor space with lots of trees and plants. And it's just a really calm morning to remember that loved one, that person.
You also, in the fall, are planning on a conference, kind of a bigger event, where you'll get a lot of people together to discuss different aspects, in the community of those who are dealing with this kind of grief, correct?
Yes, that's correct. In October, we are hosting the National Loss Team Conference. So that scene response that I mentioned is actually a national model. It was started by Frank Campbell in Louisiana in the 90s. And so that response exists in other places. And so this conference is drawing all of those groups together, as well as clinicians, businesses, anyone interested in learning how to support survivors of suicide loss. This work of support afterward is called postvention. People who have lost someone to suicide are often at a higher risk of suicide themselves. And so we say that this work of postvention is also very much prevention. And so this conference will be all things equipping survivors, equipping clinicians, equipping loss teams, and just all of us looking toward the future and how we can help each other be there for the future.
Angela Damon is Executive Director of Loss Community Services here in Columbus. It's an organization that helps those who are survivors who've had loved ones lost to suicide. There are support groups, as we just discussed. There's a big conference coming up. They do remembrance events. Their website is losscs.org, Loss Community Services. Angela, I know there's a lot going on in your organization. We've talked about a couple of the things. What else would you like to share with us today?
One thing I would like to highlight is the impact that this has on so many individuals. Studies show that for each suicide death, there are about 135 people impacted. And you can imagine, varying degrees of impact. Not everyone is going to be long-term bereaved in the same way, but it is really wide-reaching. And so when we look at the people around us, just being sensitive to what they may have experienced, but also I kind of want to highlight the impact that this has uniquely on men who, are impacted by just as many suicides as women, but tend to not seek help or respond to support in the same way. And I actually read a study just recently that was looking at the impact of suicide loss on men, and that, it's not just, oh, it's emotional, it's how they feel, but it can lead to, physical impacts and productivity and things like that. And so I just wanted to highlight the value and the importance of this for all people, for men and women. It doesn't matter if the loss was recent or it was long ago. I really invite you to engage with our community because that's what we are. We are a community. We do have support groups, but we have a lot of other things, and we're really working to have more of a men's initiative. We did a attended a Blue Jackets game recently that they did with us in sponsorship, and so we're just looking for more and more ways to bring men into this area that we know is very impactful for them as well.
Another area where the conversation maybe has increased and become more comfortable is in talking about mental health in men. I think that's a really important point because sometimes men get left out of the conversation. Of course, it's important to mention right now as well that if you or someone that you love is having thoughts of suicide or having troubling thoughts, there is always help. The National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. You can call or text that at any time, and trained professionals are available. And of course, wonderful organizations like LOSS Community Services are also available for the community of survivors in a situation like this. Angela, we are almost out of time. Is there anything else that you didn't get to add yet?
I so appreciate you sharing that National Lifeline because that is really important and it makes such a difference for people. And it's a resource that anyone can share with anyone. I think that's really empowering. With that, we also offer suicide prevention training. We're not crisis response. If you're in crisis, please call 988. They are fully equipped to help with that. But if you're looking to be a little ahead of the game and get some more information, we do offer suicide prevention training as well.
The website is losscs.org. May 4th, they have their Loss Bowl to Win event at Sequoia Pro Bowl, and there's still time to get involved in that. Many other opportunities to get involved in the loss community as well, to volunteer, to find a support group perhaps, or many other, as Angela mentioned, educational opportunities. Thank you so much for joining us today, Angela. Your work is very important, and I appreciate you sharing it with us here on Columbus Perspective.
Thanks, Kate. I really do appreciate this opportunity. And I invite anyone who's interested to learn more about this community and how they also can be an installation of hope.
I'm Shanola Hampton. Every day, millions of people face hunger. Today, I will share with you some of their experiences. I'm stuck between paying for medications or paying for food. John from Maine. After paying my bills, I can buy groceries. It's sad to say, food comes last. Alice from Oregon. I thought pantries were for less fortunate people, but anybody could be less fortunate in a day or even a second. Claire from Virginia. The Feeding America network of food banks helps provide over 6 billion meals to people in need each year. No one should have to worry where their next meal will come from. Together, we can end hunger. Learn more at feedingamerica.org.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Dangers rarely lie out in the open. So no matter where you live, it's important to know harmful pests can hide in and around your home.
Here I come!
Rodents and cockroaches are drawn to food waste and garbage.
I know you're out here.
Ticks lurk in tall grasses, and mosquitoes lay eggs in standing water.
I can hear you.
Rodents, ticks, and mosquitoes can all spread dangerous diseases.
I gotcha.
Seek the facts you need at pestworld.org. A public service message from the National Pest Management Association.
President Biden has signed a bipartisan bill into law that could potentially ban TikTok. It's the most serious attempt yet to restrict access to apps that are based in or owned by China or other foreign adversaries. But what would this new law actually do? And how could it affect you? Let's verify. Our sources are the text of the law and TikTok. First, will this ban take effect immediately? No. The law says its provisions won't be enforced for 9 months. If in that time TikTok gets sold to a company not located in or owned by a foreign adversary, it can avoid the ban. And if such a deal is in progress but not complete at the end of those 9 months, the president can provide another 3-month extension to give them time to finish the deal. But it may take even longer for us to see any effects if there are court battles. TikTok CEO said the company plans to sue.
We are confident and we will keep fighting for your rights in the courts. The facts and the Constitution are on our side, and we expect to prevail again.
Now, if it does take effect, will you still be able to access TikTok? Yes. There's nothing in the law that gives the government a way to remove the app from your phone. Instead, it orders the American companies that run app stores, like Apple and Google, to take TikTok off their virtual shelves. That also means no one could update TikTok, which would eventually cause the app to be unusable, since any bugs couldn't be fixed and it wouldn't be compatible with newer operating systems. If app stores don't take down TikTok, those companies could be fined $5,000 per user. Any companies providing web hosting services to TikTok could also be fined. And finally, if the ban takes effect, would using TikTok be against the law? No. The law would only punish companies that make TikTok available to users, not the individual users themselves. There's even a specific provision that says users cannot be prosecuted. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett, joined by Lita Hoffman. She is the artistic director of the Contemporary Theater of Ohio. And if you say, wait, I've never heard of that, you have. They just have a new name. The Contemporary's mission is to harness the transformational power of theater that engages with our current moment to inspire a community of empathy. Lita Hoffman, Artistic Director of the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we might have previously known your theater company as CATCO, right?
That's correct.
And what brought about this name change?
Yeah, so about a year ago, we announced our new name, the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, and this was after a couple years of conversations with folks, thinking about how we can really engage new people in who we are and our mission. And we found that while lots and lots of people in Columbus, you know, had come to know and love CATCO in the 35 plus years that we'd been around, a lot of folks didn't know what CATCO stood for. And so we wanted to make sure that in our name was the idea of contemporary theater first and foremost, so that folks who are looking for new and fresh and interesting theatrical experiences can find us.
So when one is looking at theater opportunities or opportunities to view theater, when contemporary is in the name, is that something that denotes a specific type of performance one can expect?
Yeah, well, the way we define contemporary is really just it making sure it feels incredibly relevant to the current moment. So we typically will do plays, you know, that were written, you know, in the last 10 years. We've done some world premieres that, you know, are very, very brand new plays. And then we've done some plays that are 10, maybe 15 years old. But it's really not about when the play was written for the very first time, but how it makes us feel. So whether the play is set now, whether the play is set at some time in the past, what we do is make sure that everything we put on stage feels incredibly relevant to the kinds of conversations and ideas that are bouncing around all of our heads as we figure out how to live in this moment in time.
And that is kind of exemplified right now by the selection that is the final performance of your 2023-24 season. It's called Ride the Cyclone, and it runs through May 5th at the Contemporary, which is the shortened way to say the Contemporary Theater of Ohio. Lita, if you would, share a little with us about this current production and what exactly it's all about.
Yeah, Ride the Cyclone is this incredible play that started in Canada and then in the last few years has really just taken off and developed this amazing cult following. It is a play about a choir of teenagers, a Catholic school choir, who ride a roller coaster and die in a roller coaster accident. And I'm sure you're thinking, what a strange beginning to a musical. But what happens is the teenagers, you know, in this choir end up in this limbo space between life and death. And they're told by a magical fortune teller that one of them can live. And so the characters in this play have to figure out who is the one who's deserving of another chance at life. And so it really just starts to dive into these big questions about who are we as people, right? Each character has their own wonderful world and specificity and things they care about. And so they get to share in a song or two about who they are, what they cared about when they were alive, and what they feel like their legacy is.
Lita Hoffman is artistic director for the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, formerly known as CATCO. They changed their name about a year ago to become more of a relevant entity in the arts space in Columbus. Talking about the current show, which is on their stage until May 5th. It's called Ride the Cyclone, a musical with a very interesting concept. Now, as we finish off this current season of performances, of course, everyone's looking ahead to your next season. When can we look forward to hearing more about what selections will be up for offer?
Yeah, we have just announced our new season, and subscriptions are now on sale and will continue to be on sale throughout the summer. And so we start next season in September with a performance of the musical Big Fish.
That was a pretty popular one for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, it had a Broadway run. The music is by composer Andrew Lippa, who lives here in Columbus, which is really thrilling. It was on Broadway. It was a Tim Burton movie. It was a novel before that. So lots of folks have experienced this story in a number of different ways, and we're excited to put our own spin on it.
Something that I find really interesting about your theater as well is that when you're doing previews of shows, you sometimes offer a kind of a great break on the ticket price, the pay what you want.
Yeah, you know, this pay what you want performance model is has been working really well for us because it gives a chance for people to come early. In our first two preview performances, we're still making small tweaks to the play, seeing how audiences respond to things and adjusting accordingly. And so it gets folks in early at whatever ticket price they would like to pay, whatever they can afford.
So we know we're kicking off the next season with Big Fish. Are there any other selections you can tease for us at this point?
Yeah. After Big Fish, later in the fall, we're doing a play called Wife of a Salesman, which might remind you of a certain famous American play. Mm-hmm. What if the wife of that famous salesman actually went and confronted his mistress? And so it's a conversation about what it means to be a wife, what it means to be a mother, what are the expectations of us as women as we're making our way in the world. We are bringing back our one-woman production of A Christmas Carol that went just so incredibly well last year. Angela Iannone playing all of the roles in the story of A Christmas Carol. She's really outstanding. And then in the spring, we are the first to bring Pulitzer Prize-winning Fat Ham here to Columbus, which is a retelling of Hamlet as a comedy set at a backyard family barbecue. And then we're closing the season with The Last 5 Years.
Wow. A lot to come at the Contemporary Theater of Ohio. TheContemporaryOhio.org is the website. You can get all of the information. You can buy your tickets. You can do a season subscription. All of that good stuff. The Contemporary Theater of Ohio, formerly known as CATCO, is at 77 South High Street downtown, and they have a lot going on. We highly recommend checking out The Contemporary. Lita Hoffman, Artistic Director of the Contemporary Theater of Ohio. Is there anything that we didn't get to yet?
No, I just thank you so much for covering, you know, local art that's made right here. I think the only thing I want to add is just that, you know, most of the artists that we're working with are folks who live right here in Columbus. And I'm just so grateful to be working with such an incredibly high caliber of actors and designers and technicians who are making work right here made specifically for Columbus audiences.
It's important to note that the Contemporary Theater is one of the leading professional equity theater companies in Ohio. And while there are all different types of theater being done all over the place, those equity performances, those are actors that are really trying hard to make a living in that industry. And that's the quality of the art that you're seeing on their stage. Lita Hoffman, thank you so much for your time today, and we look forward to seeing what's next on the stage at the Contemporary Theater of Ohio.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
When you take a walk around your neighborhood and notice all the things that make it feel like home, like all the houses lying neatly together in a row, or your neighbor, Miss Rita, who always waves at you when you drive down the street, or that movie theater in the strip mall that might look a little worn down, but has the best popcorn you've ever tasted. One thing might be a little harder to notice, because somewhere tucked in that neat row of houses is hunger. It could be your next door neighbor, or your coworker, or your daughter's friend from school, because over 30 million Americans don't know where their next meal is coming from. Hunger lives in neighborhoods all around us, but it doesn't have to. Together, we can provide 1 billion meals by 2030, because everyone should be welcome at the table. Learn more at nourishingneighbors.com. Let's break the cycle of hunger together.
In honor of all those we've lost to cancer and those still fighting and thriving, like basketball analyst and cancer champion Dick Vitale.
I want to beat cancer. I'm going to beat it. That's no doubt in my mind. I'm going to win this battle.
Defeating cancer will take all of us. Join our team to help fund game-changing research that saves lives. At the V Foundation, V is for victory over cancer. V is for victory over the odds. V is for victory over health disparities, victory over setbacks, victory over the unknown. V is for victory over giving up.
Don't give up. Don't ever give up.
Donate to the V Foundation to join our team and help save lives.
Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind. It cannot touch my heart. And it cannot touch my soul.
100% of donations fund game-changing cancer research. Donate now to the V Foundation at V.org.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett, and I'm joined right now on the phone by Rai Santos. She is a team captain and setter for the Columbus Fury. If you have not heard, Columbus has a professional women's volleyball team, and they're doing pretty well. Hi, Rai. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
So when exactly did the Columbus Furies season begin? It was recently, right?
Yes. Our season started back in January in our preseason. We were here already in December.
We heard a lot about you coming, and I went to the extent of looking up what the word fury means in this in this application. You probably know, in mythology, furies were feared women of the underworld.
yes, that's exactly what we mean.
is that how you feel you and your teammates are regarded on the court during matches?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like, there's a team that is a really young team that brings a lot of energy. It's a mix of experienced players and rookies that just finished their college career. But, yes, we just bring the heat every day and in practice and in game.
Now, speaking of college careers, you played in Arkansas, right? You went to the University of Arkansas?
Yes, I went to the University of Arkansas.
And you're originally from Puerto Rico. Is that where you began your volleyball passion?
Yes, I started playing volleyball when I was 11 years old. I did all my clubs and everything in Puerto Rico, in high school in Puerto Rico, and coming to the States was a dream of mine. I went to University of Arkansas in 2010 until 2013. And after that, 2014, I started my professional career in volleyball, which, yeah, this is my 10th year as a professional volleyball player.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a career. What other cities have you played in?
I've played around the world. Like, I played professionally in Puerto Rico, but I've also played in Spain. I've played in Kazakhstan. I played 2 years in France, a year in Greece, and then this past season I was back in Italy.
Okay, so Italy to Columbus, Ohio. Has there been a bit of culture shock for you?
I already knew the culture of, you know, the American culture since I live in Arkansas for 4 years, but for sure, yes. The European culture and our culture here is completely, completely different.
What do you miss most about being in Europe?
Ooh, Oh my goodness. I just, what I love about the European culture is like, they're always outside with their families, eating with friends, you know, and that is something that you see every time you go to the city center, for example. You see everyone outside walking around. The food is so fresh and amazing. I love it so much. And obviously, like, my teammates, all the teammates that I've met for the past 10 years, like, we continue to have that communication between each other. So it's always awesome to talk with them, see how they're doing, and hopefully in the future be able to visit them. And, you know, a little vacation instead of volleyball only.
Exactly. Well, as the weather continues to get warmer, I can assure you here in Central Ohio, you'll be able to eat outside soon here as well.
I cannot wait. That will be so awesome.
Now, how are you finding the crowds at Nationwide Arena when you have those home games? Is Columbus welcoming you with open arms?
Oh, my goodness, yes. The fans are the best. I love the intensity that they bring. And I know this is a new sport for the city. As a professional, you know, professional team, because I know there's a college, Ohio State, they have a volleyball team. But just having all those fans and Nationwide, they bring the heat every night. And it's pretty awesome to play in front of our home crowd.
Professional volleyball has come to Columbus. The Columbus Fury women's pro volleyball team has been playing at Nationwide Arena for their home games. Rai Santos is a team captain and setter for the Fury. You have some theme nights coming up. I know on May 4th, it's Teacher Appreciation Night at Nationwide for the Columbus Fury match. And can't forget Mom with Mother's Day coming up. There's a tribute to Mom. That's the theme of the match on May 11th. What would you say, Rai, is the biggest surprise you had about coming to live here in Columbus, Ohio?
A funny one, the weather, of course. Yes, the weather has been very interesting. But I think, yeah, just how everyone is supporting our team. And, you know, it's a brand new team here in the city. And we have felt the support from the fans and all the great things that our team are doing for, you know, welcome more people into our games, because it's a pretty awesome, you know, opportunity for everyone to join us and to celebrate the growth of women's sports. And so I'll say those two things.
Absolutely. Well, we are excited to have you here. I know you're on your way to practice right now, so I don't want to keep you. But Rai Santos, we so appreciate you spending some time with us today. Best of luck out there on the court. We'll be cheering for the Columbus Fury.
Thank you so much for having me.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with her hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
Hey, Alex, how did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Parenting is hard. Technology can make it harder. The Family Media Plan developed by the American Academy of Pediatrics helps make it easier. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan to create the media plan that's right for your family. Whether you make a full plan or just choose a few parts that matter the most to your family, healthychildren.org/media plan is an easy-to-use tool that will help your family set media priorities and create healthy digital habits in line with your family's values. You'll also get practical tips to help make the plan work. And you can come back to revise your plan as often as you need to, like at the beginning of each school year or during summer and holiday breaks. Raising kids in the age of screens is easier when you have a plan. Go to healthychildren.org/media plan and make your plan today.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
House Bill 68 will not go into effect this week. A Franklin County judge temporarily blocked the controversial transgender health care and women's sports law. He issued a 14-day temporary restraining order. The decision came 3 weeks after the ACLU of Ohio filed a lawsuit asking for the courts to step in. The law bans gender-affirming care for children under the age of 18 and would keep transgender women and girls from playing women's and girls' school sports. 10 TV's Carly Dion got reaction to the judge's ruling from state leaders and a group that helps trans youth.
This ruling is a tremendous relief.
Opponents of House Bill 68, like Mallory Golsky with the Kaleidoscope Youth Center, say this news comes as a relief to many of the kids they work with in the community.
It buys them a little bit more time to continue receiving that care, to pursue that care if they had not already been on hormones.
House Bill 68 blocks gender-affirming care for minors in Ohio, except some cases like if a child is already on puberty blockers and hormones. They can continue taking them as long as their doctor can prove it would cause harm if they stopped. Golsky says it's a way for trans people to be able to see themselves when they look in the mirror as who they truly are.
It's a way for them to look in the mirror and not be burdened by, you know, body parts that they don't want to have there. It's a way for them to, you know, hear their voice sound the way they want it to sound.
For lawmakers like State Representative Gary Click, who co-sponsored the bill, this decision does not come as a surprise.
We have lower court disappointments, but higher court victories.
Representative Click believes if this case makes its way to the Ohio Supreme Court, the bill will eventually become law.
Because there's no constitutional right to injure children. There's no constitutional right to chemically castrate children. There is no constitutional right to this. This is malpractice, and we're going to win in the end.
About 3 months ago, both the House and Senate voted to override Governor DeWine's veto of the bill. DeWine stated he vetoed the bill because he believes decisions about gender-affirming care for children should be decided by their parents, not the state. DeWine said this is something that will continue to play out in court.
Everybody knew that this would go to court eventually. It will, whatever the decision the local judge makes, it will go up to the Court of Appeals, and I'm sure they'll go from there to the Ohio Supreme Court.
But first, the judge could extend this ban for another 2 weeks, awaiting a hearing on the case brought by the ACLU. A longer preliminary injunction could be signed, or the judge could let the law go into effect. Until then, both sides plan to keep fighting.
We know that we're just going to have to keep up this fight for the long term.
We will prevail in the end as this makes its way through the justice system.
In response to the judge's decision, Attorney General Dave Yost says they plan to fight vigorously to defend this statute, and he's confident the law will be upheld. The temporary restraining order issued by Franklin County Common Pleas Judge Michael Holbrook. In his written opinion, the judge said the law likely violates a requirement that state legislation deal with a single subject. House Bill 68 not only bans gender-affirming care for minors, but also bans transgender girls and women from competing in women's and girls' school sports. Lawmakers on both sides weighed in about that aspect of the decision.
Republican State Representative Jenna Powell sponsored the Save Women's Sports Act.
And the bottom line is that when you have a male competing in female-only sports, it's unfair.
She says the judge's decision to issue the temporary restraining order based on the single subject requirement for legislation is grasping at straws.
When we combine pieces of the legislation, which happens all the time, you know, we ensure that it's constitutional. And so I am without a doubt know that it is constitutional. We worked with some of the brightest minds in the nation, and they also know that it is constitutional.
Senate President Matt Huffman takes issue with the way the legal system works in cases involving legislation like House Bill 68, which he also says was enacted according to the state constitution.
I think there's a general concern, just stepping outside that issue, with statewide injunctions by a single common pleas court judge.
On the other side, Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio believes the law is unconstitutional.
This ruling sort of reinforces that for right now, and I'm hopeful that going forward, it will be deemed unconstitutional in general, in total.
And Senator Antonio believes both parts of the law take away the rights of Ohioans. And here's a closer look at exactly how we got here. It all started when the Ohio legislature passed House Bill 68 on December 14th of last year. Then, just 15 days later, Governor Mike DeWine vetoed the bill, saying he doesn't think the state should overrule the decision of parents and medical experts. However, on January 10th of this year, House lawmakers voted to override the veto. The Senate did the same 2 weeks later, setting the bill on course to become law. Then, at the end of March, the ACLU sued Ohio over the bill. House Bill 68 was set to take effect on April 24th. Two state representatives reintroduced Aisha's Law in the Ohio House. This is the third time Representative Sarah Carruthers has introduced this legislation. It has passed the House and stalled in the Senate twice. If passed, the law would expand the definition of domestic violence to include strangulation, require training and resources for peace officers to respond to these unpredictable situations, and help make it easier to get protection orders through the courts.
It is the most dangerous situation that our law enforcement goes into because they don't know what they're facing.
This legislation seeks to strengthen protections for survivors of domestic violence, enhance accountability for offenders, and provide crucial resources to prevent future tragedies.
The law is named after Aisha Frazier. She was killed by her ex-husband in front of their children. It was not the first time he had attacked her. Lance Mason is now serving life in prison. If you or someone you know needs connected to resources or just to talk, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline 24 hours a day. That number is 1-800-799-7233. It is a confidential hotline. Also at the State House, state leaders say Ohio's housing challenges are pervasive and getting worse. They say action needs to be taken now. After 8 months of work, the Senate Select Committee on Housing released a 93-page report titled Housing Reimagined on Wednesday. The committee held hearings around the state, gathered 35 hours of testimony from more than 200 witnesses, and did site visits. The report outlines 23 recommendations for the short-term and long-haul to fix the supply and cost of housing in our state. Some of the key recommendations are: create a housing dashboard to increase transparency about home prices, rental rates, inventory of houses, and foreclosures. Encourage alternative housing such as modular homes and tiny homes. Review consumer protections in the home buying process. Update codes for renters and look at property taxes for homeowners and incentives for builders. The committee says demand for housing is higher than the supply of homes everywhere in Ohio, keeping mortgages and rental rates high. They also say having competition in the market among builders would help bring down costs. Committee Chair Senator Michelle Reynolds says the first thing the state needs to do is take action.
We can no longer be casual about this issue. It is a priority, and we need to make it a priority because we're facing challenges that are increasingly getting worse.
To be categorically clear, we must recognize there is still work to be done. Together, we can build a future where every Ohioan has a place to call home.
Senator Reynolds says the first thing the state should not do is disrupt the free market with burdensome housing regulations. She and Senator Craig introduced four bills that morning, but the committee acknowledges it will take a long time to fix the housing challenges. They're looking at it as having goals for 6 months, 2 years, or even up to 10 years, but they say this is a start.
Every 10 years, America conducts a census to count the population. The results of that census determine how many representatives each state gets in Congress. And the combined number of representatives and senators determines how many electoral votes each state gets in the presidential race. Since the census counts both citizens and non-citizens, some of our viewers wanted to know whether people in the country illegally might be indirectly affecting elections. Verify viewer Leonard said he heard that if the census didn't count unauthorized immigrants, Democrats would lose 20 seats in the House and therefore 20 electoral votes. So is that true? Let's verify. Our sources are the U.S. Census Bureau, Pew Research Center, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Constitution. The process of divvying up House seats based on states' populations is called apportionment, and it's required by the Constitution. The current formula for apportionment was established by federal law in the 1940s. To determine how the electoral map might change if people here illegally weren't counted, we took state population data from the most recent census in 2020, subtracted the number of unauthorized immigrants in each state, and applied the formula. There's no official government count of the number of unauthorized immigrants in each state, so we used estimates from Pew Research Center, the numbers most widely cited by experts. When we did the math, we found California could lose one House seat, Texas could lose one, Ohio could gain one, and Michigan could gain one. We wouldn't know exactly how this could affect the House until those states drew up new district maps and held elections, but according to this data, Democrats would not lose 20 seats. From an electoral college standpoint, using the 2020 election results, Biden would have lost an elector in California, but gained one in Michigan. And Trump would have lost an elector in Texas, but gained one in Ohio. So we can verify, no, if unauthorized immigrants were omitted from the census, it wouldn't cause Democrats to lose 20 seats in the House or 20 votes in the electoral college. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
Teachers are dynamic leaders, shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Achieving this takes skill and expertise. They're tireless explorers, creatively discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, experimenting, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, and connecting with each other, leading by example. Experience the unique joy of helping students thrive. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready to begin? Explore teaching at teach.org, a campaign supported by the U.S. Department of Education, teach.org, and 1 million teachers of color.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
In his recent State of the State address, Governor Mike DeWine announced a new health care initiative for children called OAK. OAK stands for Outcomes Acceleration for Kids Learning Network. He says it's not about focusing on sick care, but on well care.
Historically, our system has paid for health care providers to provide care when you need that care. We don't generally reward doctors for actually keeping you healthy. Well, we're changing that in a very, very big way.
The governor calls it a first-of-its-kind partnership between the Ohio Department of Medicaid, the Ohio Children's Hospitals, and the Medicaid Managed Care Plans to change how health care for children is delivered and coordinated. He says it will prioritize better management of childhood asthma, annual well care visits for babies and adolescents, follow-up care for families after they leave the emergency room when their child has a mental health crisis, and access to the latest life-saving treatments for kids living with sickle cell disease. Joining me now to talk about the mission and goal of OAK are Maureen Corcoran, the director of the Ohio Department of Medicaid, Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, the director of the Ohio Department of Health, and Dr. Jeffrey Anderson, the chief population health officer at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
So the governor called it a first of its kind that's being rolled out here in Ohio, first of its kind for the country. Director Corcoran, I guess, in your words, what is OAK and its mission?
Well, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. So
OAK is really four things. Number one, it is focusing on certain childhood conditions that affect a large number of children. Second, using a very deliberate quality improvement science. Third, make measurable improvements over targeted measured improvements over several years. And most importantly, to do it in partnership with family members, with clinicians from the children's hospitals in Ohio, and with the managed care plans who provide services.
And Dr. Vanderhoff, why is this needed right now?
Well, Doug, the reality is that change in medicine is hard. and it can take a very, very long time. There are lots of studies that show that it can take more than a decade for real meaningful change to happen in healthcare, even after we know something is going to benefit patients. And the reason for that is it's so complex. What's so innovative about this program is it is using the science of quality and change management to address how to accelerate that by bringing together the providers, state government, and of course the insurers, and together using proven scientific methods to identify measures that matter and begin moving the ball quickly on these important measures.
And Dr. Anderson, I guess, first of all, you are the chief population health officer at Cincinnati Children's. What is the definition of population health in terms of how it relates to OAKE?
Yeah, great question. So I'll answer that by sharing that I was in clinic yesterday seeing patients one at a time, each patient giving the best care I could. Population health is understanding and trying to improve an entire population of patients' health. So for us in Southwest Ohio, that's a population in Southwest Ohio. In the case of OAKE, it's attempting to improve the health and outcomes of all children in Ohio.
But how do you tackle that? That sounds like, you know, you've got to see them one at a time, but then you're looking at that big picture.
Absolutely. It's a different focus. It's understanding what is happening with the entire population, paying attention to that, and looking for methods to improve that by working collaboratively together. And as was mentioned, that is what OAKE is trying to do. It's bringing together stakeholders, all who are very interested in improving health of children, and finding ways to work together to accelerate the way we improve that health.
So talk about how the learning network works.
Yeah. So learning networks are a type of method that allows us to bring common stakeholders together, all interested in improving an outcome, and using those stakeholders' different strengths and approaches and focuses to work together to improve those outcomes. Learning networks aren't new. They've been around for a while, and we've been participating in learning networks to improve outcomes of chronic disease, to improve safety in our hospitals. And in this case, we're going to bring together stakeholders to improve population health outcomes in the state of Ohio.
So it really is where you're learning from each other about different aspects of the health situation in a community or across the state.
You're learning from each other and also bringing together different strengths. So one aspect of learning networks is that we're going to understand the data. We're going to know what's happening to kids in, I'm going to know in Cincinnati what's happening to kids in Akron. The providers in Columbus are going to know what's happening to the kids in Toledo. And where Toledo is outperforming the providers and the patients in Columbus, we're going to learn from each other. We're going to use the collective learnings of each of those areas to improve the whole state. It's also bringing new partners in. All of the learning networks that have been so successful to date, this is unique in that it's bringing another partner to the table, and that's the payers.
Okay. Dr. Vanderhoff, why the focus on childhood asthma and sickle cell disease?
Well, it's a really good question, and the reason is because when this group came together, this group that was made up of people in the payer sector, people who are providing health care, state government, it was recognized that these are populations that we have a real opportunity right now to help in a consistent way, work with them in a consistent way to ensure that those kids have the opportunity to realize their best health. We know what to do. We know what works for children with asthma. Now it's a matter of us all working together to make sure those kids are getting what they need to be successful. The same is true with sickle cell disease. And this is a very exciting time for children and families with sickle cell because there are emerging therapies that are showing great promise. If we want every kid with sickle cell to have the best opportunity to be a candidate for those therapies, we've got to start today making sure that all of them are getting the best basic care so that they're ready when they can be considered for those advanced therapies.
And Director Corcoran, a lot of this has to do with follow-ups, where it's not, as the governor said, not just treating them when they're sick, but when they're well. So it's the preventive stuff as well as following up with them, correct?
Excuse me. Yes, Doug, that's right. And it's also about alignment. So if the incentives that practitioners work for is not aligned with the payers, that makes it harder for the doctors to do their job. So it is about the continuity of care. It's about engaging the consumer and their family in the care. But it's also about having the payers at the table to say, and I love the example of asthma that the governor used. Often when we get a medication from our insurer, you can't get a duplicate until the medicine runs out, right?
Right.
Well, if you have a young person with asthma, they may need to have a second inhaler in their gym bag with them,
right,
even though they have one at home. So having the payers there, excuse me, to be able to say, hey, if we could do this differently, or if you could pay physicians differently, that helps to align everyone's incentives.
Is that really what kind of makes this, you know, all come together and makes it unique, is that you have the insurers on board this team?
Yes. And as Dr. Anderson said, the science and the learning network has been really perfected, mm-hmm, particularly with the leadership of Ohio's children's hospitals. What is different here is that all the children's hospitals, plus all of the Medicaid managed care plans, payers, mm-hmm, and the state, payers and policymakers, are coming together in a very transparent way. So all the data that competitors usually don't want to share,
okay,
we're putting it all on the table and saying, let's really work on moving, yeah, these numbers forward.
So all of the children's hospitals in the state are on board?
All the children's hospitals have signed on, yes.
So, Jeff, a good example of what Director Corcoran is pointing to is this. We talked about asthma. We talked about how important it is for those kids to have access to their inhaler, for example, when they need it. Well, the Department of Health works with schools and educators and school nurses all across the state. Well, now one of the things that we will do is work with that network to ensure they understand that child needs their inhaler, and it's okay for them to have it in their gym bag. Mm-hmm. That's an important part of their wellness. And it's bringing all those pieces together, mm-hmm, that is what will make the difference.
And just quickly, this is not only for children and families who are on Medicaid. This is going to be a philosophy that pervades the state, correct?
Yes. If kids come in to see Dr. Anderson, he doesn't look at whether they're on Medicaid or not. So the improvements in care will benefit every child who comes to their organization or to Dr. Anderson's practice.
So, Dr. Anderson, will a family see any difference that would be noticeable to them when they come in with this system in place, you know, they come in for an appointment?
Will each individual family see a different version? No. Will they see a difference? Absolutely. That's what we're trying to do. We are trying to change systems for better outcomes for families. So we absolutely want to change what they're going to see. But it won't be different for a patient on this insurance or on this insurance.
And this is brand new right now. It's rolling out as we speak, right?
It's already underway.
Okay. And I also learned something today. I'm the only one on set who's not wearing a bow. Oh, it's Director Corcoran, but no bow tie. The two doctors are. But there's actually not only a sartorial reason, but a medical reason for this, correct?
That's right. That's right. So many of us began wearing bow ties when we were in our training because they don't get into the work you're doing. If you're bending over a bed and examining patients, it's not drooping. If you're taking care of a child, they're not tempted to yank on it.
Got to keep it clean and safe.
Clean,
right?
And safe.
All right. Well, all three of you, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge about this brand new program called Oak and its rollout as it's happening right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
10TV has reported that homicide numbers are down in Columbus compared to other years. But state lawmakers are still concerned about gun violence. A committee discussed creating a new Ohio task force on gun violence. Testimony took place in the House Government Oversight Committee for House Bill 421. The task force mission would be to examine the prevalence of gun violence in Ohio and look at ways to reduce it. A report will then be filed detailing the findings and recommendations. The bill's primary sponsor says there is a need for a new conversation that digs deeper into the problem.
This is not just legislation that we're going to just focus on gun violence. We want to focus on the root cause of gun violence.
Ohio Representative Darnell Brewer of Cleveland says Ohio had a gun violence task force back in 1994. It lasted 90 days and recommendations were never implemented.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1, The Fan.
Using my GI Bill taught me I can do anything. And seeing me graduate taught my daughter she can too. VA benefits cover tuition, housing, and supplies. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.